Welcome to the Nonviolent Jesus Podcast. I'm John, Father John Deere, and today I'll reflect with you on the climactic story of the Gospel of John, chapter 11, the raising of Lazarus, which is from my book, Lazarus Come Forth. This podcast is a project of BeatitudeCenter.org, where you can find many other podcasts and regular Zoom programs on the nonviolence of Jesus, practicing nonviolence, and working for a more just, more nonviolent world. So let's begin first with a little prayer, and I just invite you to just relax and take a deep breath wherever you are and recenter yourself. And together, let's enter into the presence of the God of peace, who loves you infinitely, personally, and everyone everywhere. And we welcome the risen nonviolent Jesus here with us. And just ask for whatever grace you need to follow the nonviolent Jesus more faithfully and to do God's will. God of peace, thank you for all the blessings of life, love, and peace that you give us. Be with us now as we reflect together on the Gospel of John, on your call to follow the nonviolent Jesus and work for a more nonviolent, more just world. Bless us, inspire us, disarm us, strengthen us, raise us up and send us out to do your will, to do our part to help end war, poverty, racism, greed, injustice, fascism, nuclear weapons, and environmental destruction, that we might be your holy peacemakers and welcome your reign of universal love, nonviolence, and peace on earth. In Jesus' name, amen. So again, as I said, I'd like to reflect on the long gospel story from the Gospel of John, chapter 11, about the raising of Lazarus. My question had always been, why is John's gospel so very different from Matthew, Mark, and Luke? As you remember, Matthew, Mark, and Luke tell the same story. Jesus is in Galilee, he's serving the poor, and Luke says specifically, he turned and faced Jerusalem, and he starts marching to Jerusalem. So that's why I always say that Jesus is like Gandhi and Dr. King on this march, bringing the poor to Jerusalem. And the story of Matthew, Mark, and Luke is that he goes into the temple, turns over the tables, and for that nonviolent civil disobedience, of course, he's arrested and tortured and killed. John's gospel is written 30 to 50 years later. There's no march to Jerusalem culminating in civil disobedience in the temple, as there is in Matthew, Mark, and Luke. He tells a completely different story. In fact, John begins with the civil disobedience in the temple. You remember right after the wedding at Cana. So why does he write the story, rewrite the story? Well, I think it's because he wanted to say something even greater to wake us up. And how would you do that? So here's my thesis. And you might like to get my book, Lazarus Come Forth, where I really go deep into this. John rewrites the story of Jesus to portray the nonviolent Jesus as the God of life in nonviolent confrontation with death and the powers and systems and empires of death, and therefore calling humanity in the person of Lazarus out of the tombs of death, the culture of death, out of empire, and commanding us to unbind humanity and let humanity go free in the fullness of life here and now in resurrection peace. That's the message. Have nothing to do with death and therefore with violence, war, injustice, and the means and metaphors of death. So that's why you hear so much about eternal life is now, and those who are alive have nothing to do with death. But if you have anything to do with death, then you're not in the fullness of life. I have come that you might have life and life to the full. Once you begin to read the gospel that way, this is again a hermeneutic of nonviolence, then the whole Gospel of John makes much more sense. And it's very exciting. And the key in this understanding is that Lazarus represents the entire human race. And that's why I say, if that's true, then it makes sense that in the year between 100 and 120, the community of John rewrote the story of Jesus to this new climax of the God of life calling humanity out of the culture of death, because the next scene is the Last Supper. So in chapter 10, we hear all of Jesus talking about life. He's the good shepherd come to bring life and life to the full, to the flock. And if you read it carefully, how do the people of Judea, the Judeans, respond? They pick up rocks to stone him to death, but he escapes. This is another assassination attempt. You know, everybody says the Gospel of John is so spiritual, but there are over 25 death threats and assassination attempts against Jesus in John's Gospel. I wonder if you all knew that. So the next verse, chapter 11, verse 1, we're going to hear about Lazarus, and this is where it begins. So I invite you, either maybe after you hear this podcast, to go and reread the Gospel of John, chapter 11, where it says that Jesus had agape for Lazarus. He loved Lazarus, his friend, and Lazarus's two sisters, Martha and Mary. Well, that's very unusual right there. I always see them as Jesus's best friends. Like, this is the one safe place where Jesus can go to and let his hair down, and whatever he says is accepted by Lazarus and his sisters. So we're told Jesus hears that his dear friend Lazarus is dying and dead. And then we're told Jesus waits 2 days and then says, let's go to Lazarus. And that's when we're told the first time about the male disciples. Now, the way I read chapter 11 is the story is all around Jesus, there's all these various groups of people, and they're all caricatures. And the first group we meet are the terrified, clueless male disciples. I always think of them as, think of the Keystone Cops or the Three Stooges. That's the Marx Brothers. That's my image of the male disciples. And they start arguing with Jesus. What, are you crazy? Those people just tried to kill you, and you want to go back there? So in chapter 10, Jesus was in Bethany, and they tried to kill him. He's left, and now Lazarus has died back in Bethany. He's waited a couple of days, and he said, okay, let's go back. And they say, we can't go back there. What, they're going to kill you. So notice, the male disciples try to stop Jesus from going back to Bethany, back into the midst of the would-be assassins, to be with his best friends. And it's then that Jesus calls Lazarus our friend. Lazarus is their friend too. Our friend has died. So we're going back there. Now that's the heart of the whole gospel. What are you willing to do for your friends? There is no greater love than to lay down one's life for one's friends. Aren't you guys willing to lay down your life for your friends? Let's go. We're going back. So that's why it's so exciting and beautiful. The nonviolent Jesus always acts in a spirit of friendship, community, and nonviolent love. For him, laying down one's life for one's friends is natural. This, to me, is the height of fullness of nonviolence. The nonviolent Jesus at his best, the way that he wants us to live. And I can't say it with a straight face. How do the male disciples respond? I think we have one of the greatest, funniest lines in the Bible. Thomas, who will later appear being the doubting Thomas, turns to the other disciples and says, I mean, this is almost like a Mel Brooks movie. Let us go and die with him. Now, when you read that, you might be going, wow, they really get it. They're going to follow Jesus even and stand with him. This time they really assassinate him, and they're going to suffer and die with him too. And what happens? For the next 3 pages, the rest of the story, they're nowhere to be seen. And it's very clear to me, they never appear, which means they don't go back with Jesus to Bethany. They don't appear until chapter 12. I think because the writing is so brilliant and John, the writer, knows what he's doing, this is a caricature of classic macho male churchman, talking the talk but not walking the walk. Let us go and die with him. So we can ask, because we can do this with all the different people in the story, what part of us is like the male disciples who make great promises to the nonviolent Jesus, but do not walk the walk with him to confront the culture of death? So it says Jesus walked back to Bethany, and it gives an incredible image of Jesus walking alone to Bethany, back to face the crowd of people that just tried to kill him. And he's going to stand with his friend Lazarus. Now, I say Lazarus represents the whole human race. Why? Because two chapters earlier, if you can hang in here with me, John chapter 9, the famous story of the healing of the blind man, begins with this sentence. If you read any translation today, it says, Jesus walked by and saw a man born blind from birth. That's John chapter 9, verse 1. In the original Greek, because of the way the language is, it should read, Jesus walked by and saw humanity born blind since birth. I think that totally changes the whole story. And then it all makes sense that Jesus is the only one who can see. He's the light of the world come to give vision to the human race. And now John ups the ante by having Lazarus, because we get that now, that these are Jesus, that Jesus is talking about the God of life versus the whole human race and therefore death. Lazarus is humanity. And so, well, then, as I said, it makes sense that he rewrote the story. So Jesus walks totally alone back to face the death squads. He's vulnerable, unarmed, perfectly nonviolent, the only one who really values friendship more than anyone else. Later, a couple chapters later, the night before he's killed, he says to these guys, I no longer call you servants, I call you my friends. So John is trying to tell us about a God who wants to be our friend. Everything comes down to friendship and agape love. Then we come to the next group of people. These are the professional mourners, the Judeans of Bethany, who are weeping over the dead Lazarus. They're totally devout. But they're the same religious people who just tried to kill Jesus. They're fulfilling their religious obligation to mourn Lazarus, and they show public sorrow for his death, yet their hearts are full of murder and violence. I think that's very instructive and powerful. And I read John thinking he's saying, and well, how are you like them? How are we like them? And then we come to the next group, which are perhaps the two greatest disciples in the four Gospels, Martha and Mary, the beloved heroic women who come closest toward accepting the nonviolent Jesus of anybody else, in my mind, beyond Peter. Now, they've begun the ritual 30 days of mourning, and they're besides themselves with grief. Okay, we're told that. And we're told twice that Lazarus has been dead for 4 days. Okay, Lazarus has been dead for 4 days. And then we're told again, Lazarus has been dead for 4 days. Why are we being told that? Because according to Jewish belief, the soul of the dead person leaves the body after 3 days. In effect, you could raise a person from the dead after 2 days, but after 3 days, don't bother. There's nothing there. Lazarus is dead for 4 days, and we know that now. Lazarus is gone. In other words, Jesus is too late. There's nothing that can be done. And so we hear Martha cry out, Lord, if you had been here, my brother would not have died. Mary will later cry out the same thing. It's very instructive. This is the voice of utter hopelessness, a voice we all know well. And it's just saying what we all think deep down, that deep disappointment we all have in Christ before the power of death. Lord, if you had been here, how many times do we say that, like Martha and Mary? Then our relatives and friends and people around the world would not have died, would not be dying. There wouldn't be so much death and death wouldn't hold power over us, and we would not be waging permanent war and threatening to blow up the planet and letting billions suffer in poverty and just be racing toward catastrophic climate change. We say all of that, and the vulnerable, unarmed, nonviolent Jesus looks us in the eye and says the most important thing in human history: I am the resurrection and the life. Whoever is fully alive here and now, in the present moment of resurrection peace, and believes in me as I walk the way of life and nonviolence and confront the forces of death with me, will never die. Do you believe this? In my book, The Questions of Jesus, I think I say that that's one of the greatest questions ever asked. And I like the poet Rilke, who says, when you come across these once-in-a-lifetime questions, Rilke says, don't answer it. Sit with it for about 10 or 50 years, and then live your way into the answer. I love that. So here's where it's just, John, the writing is so brilliant. Jesus sees Mary and the others weeping, and it says he's deeply troubled and really upset. By the way, a lot of translations say he's angry. It's the only second place in the four Gospels where it says Jesus got angry. But that's not what it says in the Greek. Everybody's weeping, and Jesus is there now in Bethany, and he's really upset over this, okay? And he asks, where have you laid him? And the Judeans, the people of the culture of death, are really eager to show him the tomb, and they say three devastating words: come and see. Now, those three words should wipe us out. They should sound very familiar. The whole Gospel of John begins with those three precious words of invitation. Remember, Master, where do you live? The nervous would-be disciples say to Jesus, and he turns at the very beginning of John and says, come and see. These are the words of invitation that the nonviolent Jesus uses, inviting us into the new life of agape, universal love, universal peace, and total nonviolence, the life of discipleship to Jesus. And now, the professional mourners, what I call the people of the culture of death, the people who just tried to kill Jesus, try to recruit the nonviolent Jesus into discipleship, into the culture of death. That's incredible the way John is ramping up the story. And that's when we get the famous shortest sentence in the entire Bible. And Jesus wept. And they shake their heads in disbelief and say, oh, if only he had done something. Isn't that, that's just too bad. And that sounds familiar too, how often we shake our heads and say, oh, if only Jesus had done something. Now, think about this. Nobody believes in Jesus. Everybody believes in death. How does this make Jesus feel? That's the question of a follower of Jesus when you read the Gospels. Jesus has given his life for everyone. He comes with the gift of life. He offers every possibility of new life and the fullness of life. And he is the God of life. And how is he received? Completely and totally rejected by us, the people of the culture of death and war and Roman Empire and American Empire. Hey, Jesus, come and see our ways of death. And so we're told Jesus breaks down sobbing and weeping. Dear friends, contrary to everything we've been told for 2,000 years, Jesus does not weep because Lazarus has died. Earlier, we're told he rejoices. You know, remember, it says he's glad that Lazarus has died. Maybe he thinks now, maybe they'll believe him. Lazarus's friend, Lazarus is very cool. He'd be willing to do anything for Jesus. And Jesus, according to John, is thinking, oh, well, this might wake up humanity. Instead, Jesus finds everyone in the story given over to the power and control of death. And so he breaks down sobbing. Jesus weeps because everyone in the scene, the male disciples, the religious folk, even his beloved best friends, the greatest disciples, Martha and Mary, every one of them and all of us believe not in the God of life, but in the culture of death, in empire, in war. Jesus weeps not because his friend has died, but because every drop of faith and hope has died. And similarly, all of us, like all these characters in the story, at one point or another in our lives, say, I'm sorry, Lord, there's nothing that can be done. You're a nice guy. We like you. You gave it a good try, but there is no hope. Death does get the last word. And just at this moment of total rock bottom despair, when everybody's given over to death, when Jesus weeps, where you and I would now give up, as everybody else has, Jesus acts and takes action. And we have one of the greatest sentences in the Bible and in human history. Jesus approached the tomb. Now, dear friends, just sit with that for the next couple of years. Think of that image. Jesus approached the tomb. Imagine the nonviolent, unarmed Jesus walking towards the tomb of Lazarus, which I claim represents the entire human race dead in empire, in the culture of war. Now, think of the great Chinese dissident student standing before the column of tanks in Tiananmen Square in 1989. That's Jesus approaching the tomb. Think of Gandhi's nonviolent followers marching, remember in the movie, toward the Darzana salt mines, where the soldiers with their clubs were going to strike them down, and they struck down over 1,000 unarmed marchers. Think of Dr. King and the civil rights activists walking through the park in Birmingham, Alabama in 1963, facing the troops, the dogs, the fire hoses. Think of Daniel and Philip Berrigan and their friends walking into Catonsville, taking out the draft files and burning them in the parking lot with homemade napalm. Or Dan and Phil entering the GE plant outside of King of Prussia, Pennsylvania in 1980, where they hammered on nuclear nose cones. That's Jesus approaching the tomb, the culture of death. Here we have the God of life walking right toward the culture of death. And the nonviolent Jesus, whom John says is the living God, the one who issued the famous commandments in the Bible, thou shalt not kill, beat your swords into plowshares. And in the Synoptic Gospels, the Sermon on the Mount, Matthew, Mark, and Luke, love your enemies. This Jesus, this God of life, now issues three brand new commandments, which I invite you, dear listeners, to spend the rest of your lives trying to fulfill. The first commandment, take away the stone. What? What are you trying to do? Martha shouts, this just kills me. Here, is she the greatest disciple? And what is she trying to do? Stop Jesus. No, not that, Lord. Look, you don't understand Jesus. There's nothing that can be done. He's been dead for 4 days. Lazarus is gone. Death has won. Please don't trouble yourself. In other words, please don't trouble us. In other words, please don't make a scene. Please don't break the law. Please don't make us confront death. Even if you are the Son of God. And finally, she blurts out, for God's sake, think of the stench. I think it's actually kind of hilarious. I always think of Martha and Mary as kind of Lucy and Ethel following the nonviolent Jesus. So, I thought you'd laugh at that. Martha protests Jesus' commandment to take away the stone. She tries to stop Jesus. And this is so important because this is what we all do at some point in our lives. I think it's the voice of total despair, the voice of no hope whatsoever, the voice which says, once you're dead, you're dead. She resists the commandment, take away the stone. The question is, why? Why does she do that? Why does Martha try to stop Jesus to prevent him from raising Lazarus? Why do we resist this great commandment? Because we don't want resurrection. We don't. We don't want new life. We can't handle that much hope, that much freedom, and all its social, economic, and political implications. We prefer to live off the comforts of the culture of death, and therefore empire and war in the First World. There's nothing that can be done. Besides, if you get involved and try to do something and roll away the stone and resist the culture of death, it's going to get real messy. For God's sake, think of the stench. And Jesus says, take away the stone. It's a commandment. And all we're told is that the stone is taken away. Now, everyone, again, says the Gospel of John is the most spiritual and it's so mysterious and it can't be understood. Well, if you don't read it from a perspective of nonviolence, you can't understand it. But here, in the most spiritual of the Gospels, for the first time, all the way up through chapter 11, for the first time, Jesus prays. Isn't that shocking? At this climactic moment, and he turns and speaks directly to God. Now, what's so amazing is at the beginning of the story, this makes me laugh too, Martha tries to teach Jesus how to pray. And I just want to go, don't do it, Martha. Big mistake. Because I can see her going, I'm sure, Jesus, that God will grant whatever you ask for. I'm going, don't try to tell Jesus how to pray. So notice Jesus does not pray as Martha tried to tell him to do. Instead, he does something completely different. So the stone is rolled away. There's the tomb. And he does something even more radical. He looks up to God, go back and read it, and says simply, thank you. That's a very powerful instruction. Jesus teaches us to be people of gratitude, who live in relationship with the God of life, right? Who give thanks to the God of life, right? But for what? For every action which rolls away the stone from the culture of death. We should be spending our days giving thanks for every movement, every activist, every peacemaker, every person and group of nonviolence in the world that brings forth justice and peace and the beloved community, for everyone resisting and rolling away the stone from the culture of death. Then we get the second commandment. Lazarus, come forth. Now, again, I'm going to keep repeating this. Lazarus, to me, is the whole human race buried dead in the tomb of the empire of death. That's all of us. All of us stuck in the culture of war. We're all dead. And the God of life and the nonviolent Jesus calls each one of us out, the whole human race. Here's my translation. Leave your tombs. You do not have to be dead anymore. You don't have to go along with the culture of death, with empire, with warfare. Come out from the power of death. I command you, come forth and live free from the forces of death. Live from now on in the new life of resurrection, peace, and loving nonviolence. Wow. And so Lazarus rises, and it's very interesting. He appears at the door of the tomb, but we're told in great detail that his hands and feet are tied with the burial clothes, and they're wrapped around his face. What does that mean? That means, if you think it through, he can't hear, see, speak, reach out, or walk. Why is that important for John? Those are actions which symbolize discipleship to the nonviolent Jesus. The disciple hears Jesus, sees Jesus, speaks the good words of Jesus, reaches out in service to Jesus and others, and walks following the nonviolent Jesus. Lazarus, the human race, is still a victim of the culture of death and still unable to follow the nonviolent Jesus. And so we have the third great commandment, the conclusion. Unbind him and let him go. In other words, it's one of the great lines of the Bible. unbind humanity from the trappings of death and empire and war and violence, and let humanity go free to live in peace and love, to follow the nonviolent Jesus. Do they do it? We don't know. The story ends there. The story is left unfinished. In other words, Lazarus, humanity, is still standing at the entrance to the tomb. Humanity is still stuck in the trappings of war and violence and death, waiting for us to unbind. Our mission, dear friends, according to the Gospel of John, is to unbind humanity from the culture of violence, the empire of death, from all its trappings, and set humanity free, to set each other free to live in peace and love. So when I read this story, which just gets me when I read it this way, through this political hermeneutic of nonviolence, well, then I see the raising of Lazarus, in fact, the whole Gospel of John, as the symbol of the nonviolent struggles of liberation from all oppressed people throughout history. In other words, chapter 11 is the story of Martin Luther King and the Civil Rights Movement calling African Americans forth from the tomb of racial injustice and segregation and unbinding them to live free. These days, we're trying to bind them again, you know, as we dismantle voting and civil rights. Chapter 11 is the story of Mandela and Archbishop Tutu and the resisting masses ordering the stone of apartheid to be rolled away to allow the South African people to come forward into freedom. It's the story of Dorothy Day refusing to take cover in the fallout shelters during the nuclear air raid practice drills in the early 1960s. It's the story of Dan and Phil Berrigan at Catonsville and in the Plowshares actions. And it's our story, too, whenever we join the movements, the grassroots, bottom-up, people power movements of liberating nonviolence and daring resurrection civil disobedience. Jesus goes forward and acts, and he wants us to do the same, to take bold, public, nonviolent action to resist the culture of death and war and empire, to call humanity out from the trappings of death into the new life of justice, disarmament, healing for creation, liberation for the poor, that everyone may have life and the fullness of life. So as I conclude, dear friends, I think John's gospel calls us to fulfill these three new commandments of the nonviolent Jesus. Take away the stone that keeps humanity stuck in empire, war, poverty, racism, injustice, and the culture of death. Humanity, come forth and unbind humanity, unbind one another to live free in the new life of love and peace. The culture says nothing can be done. You'll always have nuclear weapons. You'll always have war and corporate greed, white supremacy, racism, poverty, fascism, empire. We'll always have violence. Death is in control. Nuclear weapons, climate change, and fascism. In fact, get the last words. Come and see the ways of the culture of death. And into this dark night, this maelstrom of gloom, this hurricane of violence and death, the voice of the nonviolent Jesus still rings out. Take away the stone. Come out of your tombs, unbind one another, and let everyone go free. Our job is to obey these commandments, to resist the culture of death, to have nothing to do with death anymore in any of its forms, to call people out of war and killing, to invite people into the new life of peace and nonviolence. And that's what I think we're all called to do. I hope you find this helpful and that it might inspire you to go back and reread John 11 from a new perspective, and you might like to get my book, Lazarus, Come Forth. Thanks so much for listening to this episode of the Nonviolent Jesus Podcast. You can hear more podcasts and find other upcoming Zoom programs at beatitudecenter.org and sign up to receive our free e-blast with news about other upcoming podcasts and Zooms. And please tell your friends and coworkers and church people about this podcast. It's the only way the word will spread, you know, by word of mouth. And I hope you might also get my new book, Universal Love, Surrendering to the God of Peace. And if you're on Substack, look me up at Father John Deere. May the God of peace bless you all. Keep on following the nonviolent Jesus. Go and unbind humanity and let everyone live free in the new life of resurrection peace. See you next time.